Welcome back to the 2012 CROST Symposium on Unlocking the Future panel discussion. You see before you four of our speakers from the event, Harley Eagle, Cecilia, pardon my pronunciation, Menhivar, hope I get it right, Doris Marie Provine, and David Dorfler. Sorry there, David. And they are going to have a dialogue among themselves and with you for two questions that we have posed to them, and then after that we'll take questions, and we need to finish about 3:25 in order to have time to set up in Centennial Hall for the community response program. And so the first question that we wanted to ask the panelists to respond to was to connect some of these themes, connect the dots, if you will, for us about the intersection of mass incarceration topic, racism, the war on drugs, and the criminalization of immigrants.
Let's start. Hi. We were lucky. Carolyn told us these questions in advance, so we had a little bit of time to think about them. And I thought maybe I could start by saying it's really ironic that two Democratic presidents, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, have both been involved with major harsh enforcement actions. Clinton kind of had a double header, both immigration and criminal justice. Obama has led to historically unprecedented numbers of legal permanent residents and unauthorized immigrants being deported, and we're hitting every year an all-time high, and it's 400,000 this year, and that's a lot of family members broken up. And so what's going on, and why are they both associated with both policies? Obama hasn't done much on the criminal justice side, so I'm kind of lumping him in that way. And as I think about it, what kind of links it all together for me is that we're talking about very vulnerable populations that don't vote, that don't have political influence, that don't have the money to be part of the PACs of any major contributors. We're talking about what someone talked about at lunch today of the exploitation of race and racism. Race may not exist, but racism does, and the kind of underlying racial fears are part of the political process in our country in both cases. I think our sense that law is colorblind when it really isn't in operation is another thing these two have in common. And I think we have in this country a very disturbing penal preference. We prefer prison as a way to show we're serious about issues, or in the case of immigrants, detention and deportation. So we've kind of gotten into the habit of thinking when you really care about an issue, if it's really important, then it deserves to be a crime. So that's why I think these presidents, Democrats, Republicans are just as guilty, but Democrats in a way seem the more ironic. We've sold out on the poor, both parties have. We've recast the poor as undeserving. I'm old enough to remember the war on poverty when we thought the poor were sort of victims. Now we think they deserve it. And I think we've hardened laws for political reasons, not even very personal, just because it's politically convenient in an interest group-driven system to go after the weak interests and kind of get some organic solidarity with those who feel that they're not in those groups.
I can go next, if that's okay. For me, what I think ties it all together is this basic idea that Michelle Alexander mentioned yesterday, and that we have all addressed in some way, we have all brought attention from different angles to this issue of the dehumanization of vulnerable populations through the law. And so so we see, for instance, and so once you dehumanize these populations, for instance, then we, as a society, we start to think of people as having no rights, no humanity, they're not persons anymore. So we can, as Michelle Alexander was mentioning yesterday, so someone who's deemed a felon, that's really... doesn't cannot really live outside prison anymore. They cannot get jobs. They cannot get aid for housing. And look at the case of immigrants who are undocumented and therefore have been criminalized. Their behaviors and their practices and what they do has been criminalized. They also do not have rights, and they keep on losing rights. And now we even have documented legal immigrants losing rights as well. So, and underlying all this is a set of laws that permit this dehumanization, this through criminalization. And I think something that we can think about is how to restore, if we're thinking about restoring something, as Harley was saying, restore what? I'm thinking restore this very basic idea of humanity, that the people are human beings, that we cannot let the formalization, the laws dictate otherwise. So I think that's something that I just wanted to comment on.
I assume this is an oversimplification, but I think that's where it finds its profoundness, where I'm able to connect these dots is at the level of a real personalization of the process. First of all, I have to say to Harley, you renewed my spirit. I love you as a brother and as an embodying those values. It seems to me the importance of us looking for that common journey that we're all on, the concentric journey, if you will, is critical for pulling these dots together. When we can be aware of our own self-awareness and work on that personal journey is where we cut through all the abuse that is happening on a larger basis. I really think the common ground is seeing the pain that unites us all, and the need for healing.
Thank you, David. It's David and I have known each other for a lot of years, but we haven't seen each other in a lot of years, so it was wonderful to be able to hang out with him and hear him again and experience him again as human to human. It's wonderful. I'm a big fan of Cesar Millan. I don't know if you know who he is, the dog whisperer. And he addresses the problems of pet owners, dog owners, by reminding people that they have, it's not the problem with the dog, it's the problem with the people, that they have treated these animals, these dogs, as humans, putting human psychology into a dog's life, and it confuses them. And so they're reacting to this of just not understanding what's going on because they haven't used human psychology with or dog psychology with them. And sadly, I think we've done the opposite in this mainstream society, in this world, is that we've treated each other as animals. And so we need to get back to treating each other as humans. We've dehumanized whole sets of people. And further to that, just as what Cecilia was saying, and Michelle talked about it in the first night, that kind of at the core of it, at that iceberg at the bottom, is this understanding that some of us are superior and others are inferior, and therefore you can do terrible things to the inferior people, and we have the answers as those of us that feel that we're superior. And we all end up participating in those at some different levels. It takes on these crazy, amazing dynamics once that process is, that pattern is around, so we end up following that pattern. And I liked what Michael Gilbert said today at the luncheon speech, and he talked about changing the minds, changing your mind, changing the mind. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to change this understanding, this pattern of treating each other as inhuman ways to ways that are more human. So it's about pattern change. I think the way that you do that is to recognize patterns, is to figure out, okay, what are these terrible patterns? And the way to, and a good way of doing that is to use patterns that are more in keeping with who we are as humans, to practice being humans. It's sad that we have to do that. But I think that's another thing that restorative justice has done for me over these years, is that it allowed me to practice how to be a human. And so these processes built on those values that I talked about have helped me to restore that understanding. And I still got a ways to go, but I'm in the process of changing my mind.
Thank you. Now, for the second topic, we have a question that is probably many of you have wanted to know. What do you do? What do you recommend as the next steps for anyone who wants to engage with this year's CROSS topic at the intersections of mass incarceration, racism, criminalization of immigrants, and the war on drugs? What do you recommend that we do?
Well, maybe I'll go first again on this. I think you hear the political scientist in me in some of this. And I'm going to say a real political science-y thing, or a real politics thing. And that is, you know, the other side that fortunately hasn't been represented here today, what we might call the pro-repression side or the pro-dehumanization side, it's really captured our political system, and that's important because when we have laws that essentially dehumanize people, whether we're talking about indigenous populations or we're talking about immigrants or we're talking about drug felons, people's minds begin to change. Other people, the observing public, begins to dismiss the humanity of those people, which gets us back to the point about humanity that is getting raised here. And so I think we've got to take a cue from those pro-repression, pro-dehumanization folks and say, we need to figure out a way to begin to capture the system, to capture the laws, to make them something other than what they are in order to change minds. You know, it's a myth that people, you know, like atoms, come up with ideas and then enough atoms have an idea and it becomes a law. That a lot of the time it goes the other way, that leaders, they implant ideas in us and then we kind of think of them as our own. Look what happened with the drug war. I think it was Michelle who mentioned that 3% of the American public thought it was a big issue, and then within just 2 or 3 years it became a huge issue because it was pushed by that leadership. So I would get really real specific with this, and I would start thinking about, okay, how do you begin to capture the political system, at least in the areas that we think are really important? And, you know, it kind of reminds me of a discussion we were having the other day at an organization I work with that is very much against building still more maximum security prisons in our state. And Cecilia's in my state. We already have 8 private prisons, and our governor wants to build 2 more. She has lobbyists on her payroll, really, frankly. And so this campaign started with, well, write the governor a postcard. Well, of course, the governor was the one who's been pushing the idea. So I assume I can just see her kind of lofting the postcards into the trash each day. What we really need is to think, in Arizona anyway, about a piece of legislation that we can push. Even if we go down in flames in 1 year, maybe in the next year we'll get some publicity for that. We can lobby for that. We can talk about it. I think we're going to need to start really kind of focusing on issues that at least sound like they could be bills and propositions, and then try to get people behind those. Of course, it's wonderful to change and learn at the individual level, but if we're talking about getting systematic change, I think we really have to start getting very political about how to get that system to change, and then the great mass of people who aren't thinking so critically about things might begin to look at things a different way.
Thank you.
I'll go next, I suppose. And I agree with Marie, yes. But also, following up on the point I made earlier, I think a very important aspect of this is sort of to recognize, to sort of engage in a project of recognition, what the law does to the lives of people. Very similar to what Harley said earlier this afternoon. Once I interviewed a Catholic priest in Phoenix, and since 2005, he's been telling me that all these laws do damage to the soul. And it reminded me of I think at lunch we were talking about that. So I've been trying to get to that, to how to recognize the damage that it's done across borders. And in my area, it's immigration, and I work with immigrants. But also, you can see this across to other groups. For instance, the damage that deportations do to people and families. It's not unlike the damage that family separation in the context of incarceration does to the families of those who are incarcerated. The family separation and the uncertainty of living separated and not seeing each other or not seeing relatives because they're kept apart through the law. So I think it's a project of recognition. It's very important, particularly for those who suffer the effects. Because when you get people who have internalized the damaging effects, it gets to a very deep aspect of the human being. For instance, in a raid that I don't know if you're familiar with in Postville, Iowa, there was a huge raid where over 400, mostly Guatemalan Mayan immigrants were detained and taken away from their community there. One of the men who was detained, the interpreter who worked in that case said that he had broken the code of silence that interpreters usually have when they're doing these kinds of cases, to expose what he had seen, because this man, for instance, he said, do whatever you want with me, I have no rights, I'm illegal. So I think thinking about this damage to the soul, this profound damage that the system does to people, is also part of this project of recognition that is important to start to do something about. But what we have today.
I think a very specific and practical thing that we can do in terms of applying the victim of the applying the principles of restorative justice is to look at what is done on the extreme levels. I really believe that victim-offender dialogue is an embodiment of those principles, and when we see what is done on those individual levels of the grieving and the healing that goes forth, it's not that because it's extreme it is less relevant to us, but instead it is capturing for us those principles that really can be integrated into the community. And so I would look for us to do a better job of promoting what we know works in terms of that underneath the iceberg that's covered with all the trauma and the fear that goes unhealed.
I think I loved all what was expressed here with this question, because I think that we have to address this at many different levels and from many different angles. There's an author that I really enjoy. He's a First Nations fellow from up in Canada. His name is Richard Wagamese. He writes fiction stuff, but he does some autobiography stuff too. But he's been through the residential schools and been through how that whole process in Canada has morphed, just like what we're talking about here. How these systemic dynamics change once you think you've stopped something, then it changes into something else. That happened in Canada too. The school, those residential school system, it morphed into a child welfare system that was doing the exact same thing, taking children out of homes. And that still has to be dealt with up in Canada at least. Anyway, he was asked one time, because his writing is really profound and it really speaks to specifically, or especially young Indigenous men. And so I was at this event where he was speaking, and somebody asked him the question, what advice would you give to young men if they were here in the room? There weren't any at that point. And he thought about it for a minute, and he said, I would tell them, you don't do it alone. And I really think that we need to embrace that there's many different ways of addressing these things. And once again, that understanding of a systemic understanding, that to realize that all of these things are connected. So we're going to have to be working at this stuff from different angles. To find what your gifts are, to find what your strengths are, to find where your network of relationships are strong and are supportive, and to go with that. And then support others who are doing this work from other angles. You know, listen to how they're doing things and say, you know, that's really good, and I'll support you the best way I can. And I'm doing this work from this angle, to realize that because we're saying that all of these things are connected, the dreadful things, our responses should be also be connected with this understanding that they're also connected to addressing and hopefully addressing the root causes of what we're talking about here today.
Thank you so much. We have time for questions. If you want to make your way to the microphones at the front of the room. We have one for hey, Tim.
TLU is a university affiliated with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And tomorrow, our speaker will talk about the social statement that the ELCA as a whole denomination is working through surrounding the criminal justice system. But I was hoping that you might share with us your thoughts about the role of faith communities. I think Michelle mentioned this last night as well. And how you see faith communities, both individual congregations and maybe larger in the sense of denominations or clusters or even organizations like COPS Metro, who is here, groups of congregations in the San Antonio area, and how they might be part of moving forward.
I think that's a fabulous thing for us to address, and I must say my one sort of pragmatic route into that is through looking at what Lutheran Social Services does in our city with refugees and how dedicated an organization this is. I'm not a Lutheran myself, but I work with them in refugee integration. And integration is actually another theme that I think unites immigrants and unites people who've had experience with the criminal justice system. How are communities going to organize themselves to bring people back in? And this gets, you can probably notice we're kind of attacking two themes here. One of, how to change the individual and what the individual can do, and then what we can do at a larger system level in some sort of short space of time. And I think faith communities have a lot to offer on that level of how individuals can learn to contribute to the acceptance and rehumanization of each other, because so many of those interactions are on the one-on-one level. At the level of political process, it's a lot more difficult for faith communities because of all sorts of legal separation between church and state. But I do think that can be tremendously important. And I know organizations work in all of these areas of dehumanized populations, and it can be just absolutely important work, just having seen it firsthand with refugees.
Actually, this is an area where I have done research, and so I have a lot to say about this. But the faith communities actually have been the few voices that have been raised for a long time to speak of the injustices, at least in the area of immigration. The Catholic Conference of Bishops, the mainline Protestant churches, the Lutherans in Phoenix, for instance, or throughout, the Presbyterians, they have actually filled in the void for many other groups who have not even, who had either not have a chance, not have been unwilling, or have been unable to say something. And so they have done this work at different levels, providing services, immediate services to immigrants, but also mobilizing resources at a higher level, appealing to Congress people, having conferences, ecumenical efforts. It's been quite an effort that other people are learning from and are basing their own their work on. I know many activists who have worked in California, have come to Arizona, have joined forces with faith communities to speak up, to organize protests, to do something about what's happening in the lives of immigrants, and for the immigrants themselves, because I also interview immigrants. They are the ones who actually pointed me in the direction of looking more into what faith communities contribute to in their lives. So I think it's a critical role that faith communities can play.
Communities of faith, I believe, can learn a lot about themselves just by using some of its vocabulary, that it be that sanctuary, that safe place that makes all the difference in the world, but also to be open and to hear those on the outside, that many times they become the most faithful in terms of what the purpose of the faith community is. And that's again, that goes back to that hard job of self-awareness, not only as an individual congregation, but as communities of faith far beyond just the individual congregation.
Just building on what David said, and I'm glad you said what you said, because I was thinking to myself, okay, this is what I have to say, but it's not going to be an easy thing to say or an easy thing to hear. One of the things that I think is really important for ourselves and for our organizations and for our faith communities is to look at our own paradox, is to look at our own contradictions, to recognize that we've also done damage throughout our history. That, you know, for myself as an indigenous person, I can name several occurrences of how the churches have participated in genocide, assimilation policies, and the demise of indigenous peoples. And that's not an easy thing to look at, but we have to be able to take that honest look at our own history, because that will provide us, I think, tremendous strength and tremendous understanding for the larger issue. Yeah, and like I say, that's not always an easy thing to say, and not a hard and not a an easy thing to embrace. But like David said, we need to have those kinds of places. And here's the beautiful thing about that: when we were living and working on Pine Ridge Reservation, we work for a Mennonite organization, and I'm full of contradictions and a walking paradox myself. When we would enter into a relationship with a local group there, or some people that wanted to explore working with us, or if we could assist them somehow, we would often get to the place of being able to say to them that we acknowledge that we represent and work for a white organization that follows racist patterns. And you know, it felt fine to say that there on Pine Ridge, where folks really know the history of what has happened to them and how the church has participated. But what would be cool about it is that they would say, ah, good, you know who you are. Now we can get to work. Hmm. And so it kind of clears the air. It's like they realize that, okay, you get what you understand that history, and that's good, you know that, and now we can get to work. And so it builds trust, and you get to a deeper level of relationship and to move the work forward. I think that's the beauty of being that truthful about your own history.
And we have another question.
This is a question for David. From your bio, I understand you've been a prison guard.
Yeah.
Is that right? Could you speak to what you would see as some immediate reforms that are needed now, and what people like us on the outside can do to help bring that about? Okay. That's with regard to the relationship to inmates and the transparency that should be in place so that when the doors are shut, nobody knows what's going on inside.
Yeah. I think everything that we've talked about this week, and I hate to generalize like that, but it's that connection that is missing, the fear that can... Well, let me state it this way. When we started the program in the prison system, what was very obvious is that they had some fear of change to accept a process like victim-offender dialogue. And in order to get our foot in the door, we had to meet their primary concerns, which was security and supervision. And once you spoke to that you were not simply a bleeding heart, but someone that has some real substance to it, to what you were about, then they would give you some leeway. And I think it's being smart and using the system that's there. The secretary for a warden is the most powerful person on that unit, and little things like that can make a huge difference in gaining their trust and building that relationship as possible. I don't know if that speaks to you. Okay. I mean, the slyness of a fox, mm-hmm. And the snake.
We have no more questions. I have one, I think. I would just like any panelist to respond. Tell me a story of restoration that has worked, a particular story that is in your life.
I think Harley did a superb job of talking about that. Restoration comes in many packages, and we need to be careful of what we impose upon not only the victim or the offender, our own stuff. And I remember a woman in particular who was meeting with the man who had murdered her daughter. And she said over and over and over again, I will never, ever forgive this man. And first of all, I dropped back a step. That's one of the most horrendous things we can do for an individual is to take our vocabulary, our understanding of what is the restorative thing to do, and shape their responses accordingly. She needed a time to deal with her rage. She needed an opportunity to grieve that had not ever been given her before because of that imposition in so many ways. But she said over and over again, I will never, ever forgive this person. And yet, in that meeting and in all the years that have followed, I've never known a person who has been more forgiving. She just doesn't call it that. And I think that's a wonderful example of what relationship we bring into the prison as well.
I have a really little story that's much less dramatic than a murder and victim story. That's very, very moving, David, of a boy named Jake who used to come to our house when our kids were too small to mow the lawn, and we had like an acre and a half. It was a huge amount out in the countryside that we were trying to whack back. So Jake would come out and mow, and one day we found a check that had come through our bank that had been, it was a very odd-looking check that had been all sort of wadded up like it had been in somebody's pocket for a month or two, and it was written in pencil, and somebody had forged, I don't remember if it was my husband's or my name, and cashed it at the local Dairy Queen, where I went all the time. I was a Dairy Queen addict. But somehow or other, they cashed the check with my name that had, you know, was clearly not from me. Well, it was Jake. He'd stolen several of our checks and was cashing them for like $25. Well, then Jake got into much more serious trouble. He ended up in a police chase, having gotten into some incident where they tried to arrest him and he fled. Then when they caught him, they beat him up because he ended up wrecking somebody's police car. And that was just what happened. And he went to prison. And we would get letters from Jake every once in a while, despite the fact that he'd sort of done us wrong, so to speak. And I remember one of these letters was he really wanted to play the guitar, but he couldn't have guitar strings because you can't have those in prison. But anyway, that relationship was sort of by mail for quite a while. And then I just heard this summer when I was back visiting the old homestead, and by this time that husband and I had been divorced for a while, and so I didn't know this story, but Jake had come back and he'd said, you know, I owe you guys because I stole from you, and the person I wanted to be, so what can I do around the house? So he ended up painting the porch. And I just thought that was such a wonderful story, because I don't think we ever totally lost faith in Jake, although we were obviously pretty disappointed with him. But he had the guts to show up again as an adult man and say, hey, I want to make this right. I want to be a better person. I was very moved by that.
I don't have a story with a final, like, with something, with an outcome. It's more of a process. And I'm thinking of the work of different faith communities at the border in Arizona, especially the people who put water in the desert in addition to putting water in the desert for the immigrants to not perish, they also tried to reach out to people, to the Minutemen, when the Minutemen were active. And the Minutemen would complain in the media of the trash that the migrants were leaving behind on their property, of all the damage they were causing. The people running Humane Borders and also Border Links, they would offer help to go clean up. And to then that would be a way for them to hopefully open a conversation with the Minutemen. These are the people who wanted to arm the border, to protect the nation from the invasion. And so it's not, I'm not sure what, if any Minutemen ever changed their minds, but the workers, a Catholic nun told me that she was actually a faith worker because she was working based on her faith. I'm not sure if they ever made anyone change their minds, but they were there doing that every day, trying to, again, bring back the humanity in immigrants and through doing simple things, they said, as going to pick up the garbage, doing things like that so that this other group would have a different image of the immigrants.
I have a few stories, so I'm trying to think of which one would be the best one to share, and I think this one is, because it has to do with Lutherans.
Oh, jeez.
In Canada, north of Saskatoon and Saskatchewan, there's this piece of land called Stony Knoll. It's kind of the highest point north of Saskatchewan, and it's pretty flat there, so it's not that high. But there's this large section of land that I think it was over 100 years ago was treaty land. It was designated as treaty land for a specific group of people called the Young Chipewyan folks. And within 8 years, the Canadian government took a large section of that land away and gave it to Lutherans and Mennonites. And they actually called it a Mennonite reservation. You can look at this story on our website. We have a website called mythperceptions.ca, and we've put a slideshow together of this story. And one of our colleagues who works for Mennonite Central Committee, he grew up in that area, and he was friends with the Little Chipewyan folks. He saw the bitterness of loss of land and, you know, the fallout of residential schools in the Indigenous community, and he saw the lack of understanding and compassion within the Mennonite community and his Lutheran friends, too, as a child growing up. And although they went to school together, they played hockey together, that kind of thing, but there was still this unresolved stuff that nobody even really knew much about. Until they got a little older, our friend and then his other friends, and they started to talk about that story, and they started to say, you know, maybe we should do something about it. And so our friend, our colleague, and some folks from the Lutheran group and from the Little Chipewyan group, Young Chipewyan, they started to talk about, well, what can we do about this? And it's been several years now, about 5 or 7 years, that they started this conversation of how they can actually restore, you know, not so much the land, because that's such a big issue. They realize they can't just give it back. But then how can we work with the Young Chipewyan folks to get restitution from the government for some other piece of land or something like that? So they started this dialogue and started to work together. And it's been hard because there's still all this animosity in the community, and our friend Leonard has faced very irate Lutheran and Mennonite folks saying, what are you doing? You know, this is our land. What are they going to do if they get it back? Are they trying to take our land? And he worked really hard to bring these folks together to dialogue and to talk. And there was one specific fellow that was really, really hard that threatened him with violence on several occasions, this older farmer. And so they carried on. He went through all of this. He took a lot of heat for this, and you know, there was just all kinds of dynamics. But about, I think it was 4 years ago, they had a gathering at this place called Stony Knoll, where they brought Lutherans and Mennonites and folks from the Young Chipewyan people together, and they signed an agreement that of partnership, that they would work together to try to make some sort of restitution. And through the years of him pressuring to get this done in the Mennonite community, in the Lutheran community, and meeting all this animosity. On the day of the event, he went up to the Stony Knoll. He was one of the first ones to arrive. And that fellow that was full of animosity towards him, that Mennonite farmer, was cutting the lawn, getting it ready. And I think that's a story of restoration, of getting to that deeper level. That fellow who never really talked with Leonard about this issue, but he had some sort of transformation inside to feel that this was an important thing to do, to go up there and prepare the land for the people to gather there. And he left. He didn't stay, but he got the land ready. And so since then, if you check out the story, it continues. The partnership continues, and we're still working at trying to pressure the government to make some sort of restitution, and Lutherans and Mennonites and indigenous folks working together.
Thank you for telling such inspiring stories. Please join me in a round of applause for our wonderful speakers.